But also, secondly, Hamas itself has been quite adept at utilizing media very, very effectively in communicating what it is both facing and what it is up against in the region, as well as obviously the many Palestinian journalists and influencers within the Gaza Strip and across the region who are tapping into a global sort of moment of deeper and deeper understanding of the kinds of geopolitical forces that are at play both in the Middle East and beyond. So there's a confluence of things that are going on, but that confluence in this moment has been to the benefit of the axis of resistance. And this is something that they've been working on for a very long time, to be able to develop multilingual media that essentially is able to utilize social media as a strength to communicate broader ideologies about what is going on in the Middle East and move it out of the narrative terrain of the global war on terror, which is the U.S. and Israel fighting Islamic terrorism. And it's been able to reframe all of that into a language of hegemony and colonialism and settler colonialism, specifically in apartheid.
Thank you so much, Narges Bajorli, Professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University and co-author of the new book, How Sanctions Work, Iran and the Impact of Economic Warfare. She's also the author of Iran Reframed, Anxieties of Power in the Islamic Republic. Her recent co-authored piece in Foreign Affairs has headlined How the War in Gaza Revived the Axis of Resistance. When we come back, we speak with Senator Bernie Sanders, former foreign policy advisor Matt Duss, and speak with a Palestinian-American doctor who just declined to meet with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The American Ruse by MC5. The group's founding member and guitarist Wayne Kramer passed away Friday at the age of 75. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East as Hamas is set to respond to a ceasefire proposal to pause fighting and release more hostages. This comes after the U.S. launched airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen Friday in retaliation for the killing of three U.S. soldiers by Iran-backed militants who attacked a base in Jordan. Meanwhile, President Biden is facing more pressure over his support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders has announced plans to introduce an amendment to remove $10.1 billion in military aid for Israel. In a statement, Sanders denounced what he called, quote, Netanyahu's illegal, immoral war against the Palestinian people. Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Brian Schatz have sent a letter to Secretary of State Blinken to pressure the Biden administration to push back against Netanyahu's rejection of a two-state solution. The lawmakers wrote, quote, Prime Minister Netanyahu's explicit departure from that position, both in his statements and in government policies aimed at undermining this internationally agreed upon pathway, is dangerous to both U.S. and Israeli national security. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Matt Duss, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy. He's the former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. Matt, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you could begin by giving your response to these recent round of U.S. Strikes in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, and what you think may come of this.
Well, I think it shows clearly that the Biden administration's strategy here is failing. Their approach since October 7 in the region has been twofold. One is to essentially back Israel's assault on Gaza unconditionally, and the second was to try and contain the conflict to Gaza. And that second part is clearly, you know, steadily been failing over the past several weeks and months, but especially now in the wake of the attack in Jordan, you know, with these attacks in Syria and Iraq, and of course continuing in Yemen. So this conflict has steadily been spreading, as anyone should have expected it to, because this kind of violence simply cannot be controlled.
And if you could say, Matt, many have suggested, yourself included, that there are people in D.C., in the D.C. establishment, who've been advocating for a war with Iran for decades. I mean, what are your concerns about where they stand now and how much their voices may be amplified? And how many of those are Democrats?
Right. As I've said, I mean, there are people in Washington, in the United States, in U.S. politics, for whom Iran has always been a target. I mean, we saw this immediately after the war in Iraq. As your previous guest said, there were people who were making clear that their goal was to move on to Iran next. So anytime there is any kind of attack or crisis in which Iran is involved, you see these voices trying to exploit the situation to once again drive the U.S. into an open conflict with Iran, which I think many understand would be an absolute catastrophe. If people thought the Iraq war was bad, they can, you know, we can only imagine what a war with Iran would look like. This is not just me talking. These are military experts in the United States who have repeatedly warned that an open conflict between the United States and Iran would be absolutely disastrous. But I think there's a political component here. You always have to take that into account. And unfortunately, you do see voices in Washington who always see a political advantage in bashing the president, in kind of promoting this kind of hawkish approach to foreign policy that I have to say has failed repeatedly. And yet they continue to make these calls for more war, more escalation, with zero accountability.
And if you could respond, Matt, to this Bernie Sanders announcing plans to introduce an amendment to remove over $10 billion in funding in military aid to Israel.
I support it wholeheartedly. I think, as is so often the case, Senator Sanders is speaking for many Americans and, frankly, I think a majority of Democratic voters. If you look at the polls of Democratic voters' opinions of the U.S. approach to the war, this is now an over four-month conflict. This is, I think, clearly a massacre with close to 30,000 people killed, huge parts of Gaza just obliterated. We've seen in the past weeks acknowledgments from Israeli officials that they understand they are not going to achieve the goal of eradicating Hamas. And frankly, no one ever really thought that they seriously could do that. So the idea that the United States is simply going to continue supporting this conflict with zero conditions, as we have been, I think is absolutely the wrong approach. And I think Senator Sanders' proposal here is the right one.
And if you could speak, Matt, about the role of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, something you've spoken about recently as well. A poll found in January that only 15% of Israelis want Netanyahu to remain in power after the war in Gaza ends, though many support his strategy his Gaza strategy of effectively crushing Hamas and also much of the Palestinian population there. So in a sense, I mean, Netanyahu is only likely to remain in power so long as this war continues. If you could talk about the impact of that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that is what is particularly dangerous here. And gets to the particularly pernicious role of Netanyahu himself. Let's remember, before October 7th, he was facing multiple corruption indictments. He was facing mass protests that had been going on for months against his government's attempts to undermine Israel's judiciary. And then on top of that, now you have a belief by a vast majority of Israeli citizens that he personally failed to protect Israelis, that it was the atrocities that we all saw on October 7 were the result of his failures. So he knows that as soon as this war stops, so does his political career. And the only hope he has of continuing to stay in power is to prolong and escalate this war, as long as possible. And that's extremely dangerous. And frankly, I think it's been a very bad decision by President Biden to tie himself so closely to Netanyahu and to this strategy. And I think we need to detach from them and show much, much more distance from what Israel is doing.
Well, indeed, Biden's reelection bid seems also to be in question, given his Gaza policy. And you've said that his administration does not seem to understand the depth of the problem arising from his Gaza policy. And I'll just read a bit from this Politico article by Jonathan Martin, where he says, quote, that a hot war in Gaza this fall may mean 30,000 fewer votes apiece in Madison, Dearborn, and Ann Arbor, and therefore the presidency. Biden especially came under criticism last month when he spoke 100 days since the October 7th attack and failed to mention at all what's happened in Gaza, the devastation in Gaza with tens of thousands killed, displaced, and displaced. And all this, as a recent YouGov poll found, 50% of self-described Biden voters say what's happened in Gaza, Israel's attacks on Gaza, constitute a genocide. So could you explain what you think the possible implications of this are in November? And also, given the Democratic, young Democratic base, why isn't someone even like Bernie Sanders calling for a ceasefire?
Well, I think I'm hesitant to ever overestimate the impact that foreign policy will have on a presidential election. But I do think we are seeing that for many Democratic voters, for many progressives, particularly young progressives, the issue of Israel-Palestine is not just a foreign policy issue. It's an issue of social and racial justice. And I think this is something the Biden team simply does not understand or are only now starting to really understand. Again, this is going to be a very close election. If it's going to come down to possibly a few hundred thousand votes in a few key states, and if a lot of these voters who you were just referencing, I doubt they will vote for Trump. They may simply choose not to vote, but they will almost certainly not work to get out the vote. They will not do the volunteering. They will not do the phone banking. They will not do the knocking on doors that's going to be necessary to maximize vote turnout for President Biden's reelection. And that should very much concern them. And I think what's going on here, it's not simply a matter of a difference in policy. I think everyone understands the stakes, what a Trump election or a Trump re-election would mean for this country. But the anger at Biden's support for this assault on Gaza is really just incandescent. It is a matter of principle for many Democrats, not just Arab and Palestinian Americans, but more broadly, some groups of Democratic voters who simply cannot bring themselves to pull the lever or check the box for a president who is supporting this. And this is not going to be fixed by dispatching a few administration officials to certain neighborhoods in Michigan or elsewhere. This is going to be fixed, if it can be fixed at all, by changing policy and ending support for this massacre.
Matt Duss, thank you so much for joining us, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy and former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Before U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken left for his fifth Middle East trip since October 7th, he held a roundtable meeting Thursday to discuss the situation in Gaza with a number of Palestinian Americans. But some of them refused to attend in protest against the Biden administration's ongoing support for Israel's assault on Gaza. We're joined now by one of those who refused. Dr. Tariq Haddad is a cardiologist and member of the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, who grew up in Gaza. He laid out his reasoning in a 12-page letter to Blinken. Included in Dr. Haddad's letter were pictures of his family members. One of Blinken's staff reportedly made sure to print the letter in color. Dr. Tariq Haddad joins us now from Falls Church, Virginia. Dr. Tariq Haddad, welcome to Democracy Now! Our condolences to you for the many family members of yours who have been killed in Gaza. If you could begin by talking about what you know of what happened in Gaza to your family members, and then explain this invitation that you received for a meeting with Secretary of State Antony Blinken and why you declined to attend.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and appreciate the condolences. I think some context is necessary here to understand why I turned this invitation down. So I have hundreds of family members in Gaza, both sides of my family, both in the town of Khan Yunis and the Gaza City. I've had about 100 family members at this point who have been killed, including physicians, pharmacists, lawyers, engineers, dozens and dozens of children, multiple small babies. I can't tell all their stories, but I just want to tell a few just for the audience. October 25th, 10 members of my family, all three generations of one side of my family, were all killed. My cousin Jamad al-Farra, his son, who is a physician, Dr. Tawfiq al-Farra, his wife, who was pregnant, two of their beautiful daughters, Reem and Hala, Jamad's brother, Assam, his wife, Samad, their daughters, Rusul, Tuqa, and Nadian, all multiple generations all killed in one Israeli missile strike. Tuqa, one of the younger women in the family, her wedding day was the day she was killed. They were all from modest means. They actually built their home themselves, ironically, the same home that the Israeli strikes destroyed. Another day, a couple days later, my cousins Hatim and Aziz al-Farra from Khan Yunis, who lived literally 20 yards from where I grew up, were killed along with 14 other members of their family, seven of their children. Aziz was actually a pharmacist, and Hatim was just an incredible community figure who always had a smile on his face, always was available to help anybody who needed it. The day before he was killed, Hatim had just gone up to my uncle and asked if we could house five families who were made homeless by the Israeli missile strikes in our grandparents' house. One child out of that whole three generations survived, Hamza. He had an amputation, was in the hospital. He woke up to find out his siblings, his parents, his uncles, and his aunts, his grandparents all had died. And then he died himself. And the next day, from the trauma injuries from the Israeli attacks, because there wasn't adequate medical care to keep him alive. A couple days after that, November 2nd, my cousins, Hani, Huda, and Wafat Haddad, all siblings, were killed in Gaza City, along with my cousin Hani's Croatian wife and my aunt. Huda and Wafat were teachers. Hani was an interior decorator. And my cousin Hani initially survived as a physician, I can tell you, is a fairly minor leg injury, but then he bled to death the next day because he had no access to any functional medical facilities since they had all been bombed and destroyed by the Israeli attacks. Hani's brother, Wael, survived and then had to witness the horror of seeing his mother buried from the waist up in the rubble, dead. And he saw his sister, Wafat, shredded into pieces. All this, they're messaging me and telling me. My other cousin, Nail, who I grew up with and had played with as a kid, literally had to bury all his family members in a makeshift grave because he couldn't even access a cemetery. And he's been going 24 hours at a time with no food or water. Even those in my family who actually fled what was thought to be dangerous areas to safe areas have been targeted. One of my cousins, Samar al-Farra, died in a refugee camp in Rafah around the time she had completed her doctorate for her PhD. And we were about to congratulate her on that doctorate when she was killed. There are family members who've died from a lack of medical care and inability to access medical care. One of my cousins, Abdul Rahim al-Farra, died because he was unable to reach a functional hospital after he was injured. Four of my family members got killed in an Israeli bombing of their car while they're ironically trying to go to the Gaza European Hospital for shelter. And then a few weeks ago, somebody on Farah, one of my cousins, died with seven of his sons. And then most recently, just a few days ago, a baby in our family, Sabar al-Farah, who's 20 days old, died from hypothermia in the refugee camp that his family was in. And this is after this 20-year-old just froze to death after 9 of his siblings and his father were murdered by the Israeli military strikes a few weeks before. The people in my family who have not been killed, arguably, are suffering a fate worse than death. Hundreds of my family are displaced. Not a single one of them is able to stay in their home. All their homes are either damaged or destroyed. One of my family members had to give birth on the rubble of her home that was destroyed, and did not even have clothes to put on her baby. Famine is common. Every one of my family members has mentioned it. They have no access to clean water. They've had to recycle water because there's no access to clean water, and they've had dysentery and gastrointestinal illnesses. Famine, one of my cousins messages me all the time saying he's gone 24 hours without food. So to answer your question, knowing all this and knowing what I've gone through week after week, month after month, checking every morning to see who's alive, who's dead, who's suffered, who can we help? And as the dead rose to 100 in my family, to 15,000 children all across Gaza, to 30,000 civilians, as I saw the famine happen, I just kept looking for evidence that our government actually cares about the lives of my family. And I saw none. I kept waiting for a ceasefire that Secretary Blinken had the ability to do, and he refused to do it. I kept waiting for a United Nations resolution to call for a ceasefire, which the United States continued to veto. I kept waiting for something, and all I saw was the opposite. I saw our U.S. strategic Middle Eastern military reserve being used to replenish the Israeli ammunitions for this genocide. I saw cruelly just a few days ago the withdrawal of funding for the United Nations that was supplying military assistance to these over 2 million people that are going through famine. So getting back to your original question, I wrote this letter to Secretary Blinken because I wanted him to see me and see Palestinians as human beings, not as some part of political game or some sort of blame game. I wanted him to see us for who we were as human beings, and I wanted him to put himself in my shoes and ask himself if he saw his family getting killed day after day, month after month, as a direct result of government's policies, and he knew that somebody in that government could have done something to prevent those 100 people from dying, the suffering of the remaining hundreds of people. How could you sit in a room, given 3 minutes to face that person, and face them knowing that that person has been directly responsible for the death of your family and all the suffering that your family has seen, and do so simply as part of a political grandstanding? And that's why I just ethically could not be there, because actions speak louder than words. And I just wanted him to see us as human beings, to empathize and not play politics and not play games.
Dr. Tariq Haddad, thank you so much for joining us. And again, our condolences for the horrific the horrors that your family has lived through in Gaza. Dr. Tariq Haddad, cardiologist and member of the Virginia Coalition for Human Rights, who refused to attend a meeting in D.C. with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. When we come back, we talk about starvation in Gaza with Alex Duval. Back in a minute.
Then that's God shall get, then that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Oh, Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child. It's got his own. The strongest more, while the weak one. one's fate. Empty pockets.
Annie Lennox performing Billie Holiday's God Bless the Child. On Sunday night, Annie Lennox called for a ceasefire at the end of her performance at the Grammys. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israel is being accused of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza as Israeli forces continue to severely restrict the delivery of humanitarian aid, food and medical supplies to millions inside the besieged territory after 4 months of indiscriminate bombardment and mass displacement. UN human rights experts warn Gaza's 2.3 million population is facing severe levels of hunger, with the risk of famine increasing daily. For more, we're joined by Alex Duval, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University and author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. His piece for The Guardian is headlined, "Unless Israel Changes Course, It Could Be Legally Culpable for Mass Starvation." Alex Duval, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out the argument you have in your Guardian piece.
So my argument is essentially that while it may be possible to bomb a hospital by accident, it is not possible to create a famine by accident. And that for some months now, and particularly in mid-December, when the Famine Review Committee, which is the sort of the highest level of humanitarian assessment in the world, an independent, impartial, professional, and extremely discreet body of experts, said that Gaza is heading towards famine. It is already in catastrophe. And these are very technical terms. And unless there is an end to active hostilities by the Israeli authorities and army, and a full spectrum of relief operations, it is inevitable that sometime in the coming months, and they said in early February, under the technical definitions, Gaza would be in famine. So that is fair warning. And the actions undertaken by the government of Israel, and the war crime of starvation is defined thus: using starvation of civilians as a method of warfare by depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies. So the main element of the crime is destroying foodstuffs, hospitals, medical care, sanitation, shelter, etc. Unless that is all stopped, Gaza will be in famine.
And Alex, if you could clarify, we just have a minute. You say that Palestinian children in Gaza will die in the thousands, even if the barriers to aid are lifted today. Explain.
So a humanitarian crisis is like a speeding freight train. Even if the driver puts on the brakes as hard as he possibly can, it will take many miles for that train to come to a stop. So the levels of malnutrition that we are now seeing, the exposure to infectious disease through polluted water, through overcrowding, and through lack of shelter, will mean that this humanitarian crisis continues. So this is a not something that can be stopped overnight, and the fact that even after these warnings were issued, even after the International Court of Justice issued its provisional measures instructing Israel that it had to undertake these key actions, that this has continued and the United States has not stopped it, makes them culpable for the crimes of starvation.
Alex Duval, thank you so much for joining us, Executive Director, World Peace Foundation at Tufts University. We'll link to your article, "Unless Israel Changes Course, It Could Be Legally Culpable for Mass Starvation." We'll continue our conversation with Alex and post it on our website. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
And you are indeed listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Wandering Rhythms coming up in just a few moments. Up at 3 o'clock is Typically Tuesday with another great new episode. Lots more great programming coming up here on CJSF 90.1 FM from Burnaby.
On the next